Welcome to Finding Proof, where we discuss all things early stage VC.
We're your hosts, Thanasis and Jenny of the Proof Fund, and our goal is to get to know the best seed and early stage VCs out there.
In this episode, we're speaking with David Beisel, who's a co-founder and partner of NextView Ventures, a seed stage venture capital firm based out of Boston and New York. So David, thank you for joining us today. Really look forward to discussing the case of NextView Ventures. And to kick it off, tell us a little bit about the fund. What is NextView about?
NextView Ventures, we're a seed stage venture capital firm. We have offices both in New York and in Boston, but we invest throughout the country. I started the firm with two of my three partners about a decade ago now, and we just closed our fourth fund, which is a $100 million fund.
Congrats. And tell us a little bit about it, because I remember your story, actually. Like 10 years ago, it was actually a story that you guys moved from the West Coast and came east into Boston, right?
The three founding partners, all three of us have lived and worked in Silicon Valley.
Yeah.
And my partner Lee was early PayPal and on the founding team of LinkedIn. And I went to business school in California. My partner Rob had worked at eBay for a number of years. And so like part of the original thesis was taking that kind of West Coast style seed stage investing in it and bring it to the East Coast.
What sort of sectors do you guys focus on? And is there a thesis attached to the fund? And how does that work?
We have a thematic approach around what we call the everyday economy. And the idea there is we're looking to invest in companies which are taking best-in-class technology and applying it to people's everyday lives. If you literally go to Bureau of Labor Statistics and look at where people spend their time and money, it's in big categories, right? It's food, transportation, home and housing, work and money, health and wellness. And so probably about 60% of what we do is consumer-facing businesses within those categories. And then probably about 40% we do is B2B business models that are enabling layer that help facilitate those end user consumer experiences. A lot of what we do is just, whether it's on the B2C side or the B2B side, it ultimately ends up touching a consumer experience at the end of the day.
And has that thesis evolved over time?
We've always been very seed stage focused, and we very much consider ourselves seed stage specialists. And we started really the firm as a generalist firm. And I think the thematic approach, it's less of an evolution. It's more about a crystallization of what we were doing anyway all along. I mean, we're not deep tech investors, and we have offices in Boston, but we've invested in 130 companies or something like that over the last decade. And we've literally never done a security deal. And it's just, that's just not who we are.
Right.
We're internet-y folks. And so it's like, how do we convey in a crisp, articulate manner about like, what are the things we do? Because we're not just a pure consumer fund either. And so it's like, it's around enabling these consumer experiences, whether the business model is B2C or B2B.
And what was the Boston connection? Because obviously, if you were looking at the consumer driven trends, et cetera, I don't think of Boston. I think of New York, I think of LA, but Valley, but what's the connection there?
As I said, we have offices in both in New York and in Boston. Probably about, over the last 5 years or so, probably about 40% of our investments are in New York, about 30% Bay Area, 25% Boston, 5 or 10% other from a geo breakdown.
Yeah,
I know that adds up to more than 100%. An increasing amount, we can talk about this if you want, but an increasing amount is outside of kind of those three core geographies. Rob Lee and I, we just joke, we end up marrying women that are from the Boston area, and so that's what we call home, but we invest throughout the country.
That's the connection. The truth comes out. That's the connection. Okay, good.
So you guys describe yourselves as pretty hands-on investors. How important is that to your strategy? And talk to us a little bit about how you work with your founders.
What I would say is we call ourselves high conviction hands-on investors, meaning we have a bias towards either leading or co-leading rounds and helping catalyze rounds come together. I think we know or are well aware that the best entrepreneurs have lots of options for their seed capital. And so we want to be on that short list of phone calls when they're exploring. And so we think that being the willing to lead around and get in front of the parade, so to speak, allows us to earn that space and being an early phone call. And so that goes towards then being really involved with the companies after we make the investment. I think at the end of the day, what do entrepreneurs care about? They care about hiring a great team, launching a good product, getting customers, and not running out of money, right? I think at the end of the day, those are the four things. And so what we've tried to do is set up systematic things that would help with our platform that help along all of those dimensions. And we can talk about those if you want. But I think more importantly than that, the phrase that I used before around seed stage specialists. And we've invested in, you know, over 100 companies over the last decade. I think we've come to a place where we have a perspective, and whether you're a consumer-facing e-commerce company or you're a B2B SaaS company, there are certain things that just rhyme in that first 12, 18 months after a seed round. And that's everything from something mundane, like how do I deal with this 409A valuation, all the way up to like more strategic, how do I think about what are the milestones which I need to accomplish to be able to raise a Series A? And so we believe our job then is to really become a thought partner for all of those types of issues at that seed stage.
Right. And what gets you really excited about a business and a founding team?
And it's funny, like each one of myself and my partners, I think each one of us are a little bit different. I am a marketer by background. And so I get excited about either marketing technology companies or founders who think about marketing from day one, as opposed to it being an afterthought.
Because I was going to say, I saw that in your background. So I was actually curious if that's impacted you getting more excited with certain companies than others.
There are some exceptions. I've invested in a couple developer tools companies, which maybe don't fit right into that mold. But I would say for the most part, if you were to draw like a straight line through the investments that I've made, and especially the ones that have worked, have ended up being, have some marketing bent to them. And it's either they're marketing technology companies in and of itself, or the founders are just market oriented from day one. Contrast to my partner, Rob, and my partner, Melody, they're both product people by background. And so they gravitate towards founders that are just exceptional product people. And they have a sense and a nose, so to speak, to be able to make and evaluate those types of potential investments, which, I mean, that's why you're in a partnership. You have people that have different strengths and weaknesses. And
totally.
My partners know that. My questions all the time are about go-to-market and how you're going to get distribution.
Yep.
Do you want to pick a couple of companies maybe that you're particularly excited about or proud about? They could be exits. And just tell us the stories. Like, how did you meet them? What got you excited? What about the thesis you found compelling? And then how did they grow up to be successful businesses?
Maybe I'll point out one or two. I mean, a good one is a company in New York, a company called Attentive Mobile. This is an SMS marketing platform, initially for e-commerce retailers. Now they're broadening their scope of customer set. Brian Long and the co-founder, Andrew Jones, is actually an interesting milestone for NextView. We've invested in repeat founders before, but this was the first time within the history of our firm we had invested in repeat NextView founders, if that makes sense. So in our first fund, they had started a company called Tap Commerce, which was a mobile retargeting company, which they ended up selling to Twitter for a reported $100 million. And when they came around to start their next company, obviously we would be first in line to back them again. And I think it was an interesting story in that in both cases, the one kind of goes to what I said a little bit before around their very marketing oriented, not just in the companies or marketing technology companies, but that they're marketers and how they just think about selling their business. It's a funny story to tell. The first time we met Brian Long, I was the founder of and CEO of both of those companies, including Attentive. He came up to our Boston office to pitch his first company, Tap Commerce. And it was like a Monday afternoon. I remember it was like cold and it was rainy. And like Mondays are always partner days, or you're in the same room all day long, blah, blah, blah. And he walked into pitch and he had a little box. And in that box were a bunch of cupcakes. And he's like, before I'm going to pitch, he's like, wait, let's just stop. Let's all eat a cupcake. And so not only did we eat a cupcake, but he had a cupcake too. We all sat around and we ate cupcakes.
That's one way to change the dynamic.
Maybe it was the blood sugar. I don't know. As you might suspect, hey, we're pretty happy after we got cupcakes. We hear a good pitch. We're like, hey, we should invest in this company.
That's brilliant.
And just kind of like, it's very emblematic of who he is as a founder. He just wants, you know, he's a sales guy, but it was in a very authentic, genuine way, as opposed to like a used car salesman kind of way, if that makes sense.
Got it. How about another company in your portfolio?
Another one in New York that's actually a fun one. And this is, it's a fun one because it kind of shows the twists and turns that startups kind of can go through. The company's called Parsec. PAR, SEC. And they have technology that really allows for real-time screen sharing between users, extremely low latency. And we invested in this company a few years ago, and their initial product go-to-market was really around gamers and allowing gamers to play games simultaneous together and real screen-to-screen playing. And that company actually started to grow virally and early revenue days. But to demonstrate the nimbleness of the founding team, it really is a COVID success story. Last March, when realizing what was going on, they kind of hacked together a Skunkworks Teams product that allowed for, within a business environment, have real-time collaboration, especially for creative professionals. And that includes gamers, designers, illustrators, actually within the movie business, as you might suspect. You want to have that real-time so you can screen share with other, and then actually take over another full screen. And last year, 2020, that business is now a multi-million-dollar business that where it just did not exist before. And at the end of the year, they end up raising $25 million round from Andreessen Horowitz, and they're kind of off to the races now. And it's all based on this core technology, which they have, which allows for low latency screen sharing between multiple users.
And you guys just recently announced a health and sustainability accelerator. Do you want to touch on that a little bit and what your thought process was surrounding that?
So we launched last year a more kind of broader accelerator. It was the first time. It was 100% virtual accelerator, which we launched last April.
Right.
And take a step back. We look at the accelerator landscape, and obviously there's been a proliferation of accelerators over the last decade or so. And we thought, accelerators, they, for them to scale, they've been just adding more and more companies to at the top of the funnel. Mm-hmm. So that just means more and more mentors. And then they have this demo day at the end, which used to be highly correlated with fundraising, but now they've kind of all evolved to a show, right? It's really just a big hoopla production. It's not really about fundraising. It's about putting on an entertaining show. And so what could you do to flip the accelerator model on its head? And so let's go back to its roots. I remember going to the original Y Combinator demo day here in Cambridge, and I think there were either six or eight companies in that. And so we launched an accelerator last year. We ended up putting out a public call. We ended up getting literally hundreds of applications. We selected six companies, and it was a diverse set from both B2C and B2B companies, actually a diverse set of backgrounds of the founders, as well as diverse across geography. We had, of course, Bay Area and Boston, but we also had Miami and Alabama, literally. Mm-hmm. And part of the program was to spend time, you know, all the each accelerator companies get to spend meaningful time each week with the GPs. And so rather than outsource the mentorship to other folks, we said, okay, we'll do what we do with our core portfolio investments. We'll do the same thing. And then rather have a big show and we'll do what we do with our portfolio companies. We'll help them raise that next round of financing. And that was the brand promise behind it. But one of the things that we found was that the companies within this virtual accelerator, they actually got a lot of benefit of being part of a cohort and connecting with those other companies. And we need to get out of the way. And so what can we do to help even further facilitate it? It's like, let's put a theme behind it so that there's a more common set of assumptions and just view of the world of those accelerator companies. So that's one part. And then the other part is we, in particular around health and wellness, we're internet-y investors, we're not healthcare investors, but over the last 3 years in particular, we invested in a number of internet-y health companies. We've invested in, I think, three or four, call it telemedicine, condition-specific telemedicine, everything from a company called Monument, which is around alcohol addiction, to a company called Form Health, which is around medical weight loss. And as you know, the worlds between health and wellness and technology are all kind of converging, and even the consumer-directed health choices. And so whereas 10 years ago, being a healthcare investor meant investing in molecules. And I mean, before I was I was at Venrock, and they obviously have quite the practice in that realm. But we at NextView see this opportunity around how do you bring digital bits to health and wellness. And so that's the motivation between putting that theme around the accelerator. And we literally just announced that last week. And, you know, I think the applications are open for a few weeks here as we're looking at companies to, you know, that cohort.
Yeah, that's really exciting. And are you planning to kind of, to your point, come out with additional accelerators that have a specific sector focus?
It's somewhat of an experiment for us. we're a seed stage venture firm first. I think the accelerator product is at a different engagement model with entrepreneurs, a different kind of life cycle of the companies. We make pre-seed investments outside of that as well. And so we're not just focusing our pre-seed investments within the accelerator framework, but you know, I think we'll see how it unfolds. I mean, I think if you ask the entrepreneurs in the previous cohort, I think their NPS was quite high. So, but I think, as you know, it takes a while to see how things unfold. And obviously we hope that some of our accelerator companies then quote graduates core investments and become successful from there.
Yeah, no, that's great.
Yeah.
Is this a way for you guys to attract additional deal flow, or is it a way to give back to the community?
No, we're not running a charity. It's less about the community. We're venture capitalists. Yeah. If it helps the community, then so be it. I think it's a way for us to, we invest across the broad range of seed investors. I mean, seed can mean a lot of different things.
Right. I was going to ask, because seed has, 10 years ago when you started, it was novel to be a seed investor, because most VCs started at the Series A, and anything before that had to do with angels and angel investing. And so I think entrepreneurs have a lot more choices now. So talk a little bit about that dynamic.
Within the last 2 years, I've invested literally 100K into a 500K safe round and all the way up to a $2 million check into a $5 million quote seed round. The former was two people, a dog, and a PowerPoint plan. And the latter was a e-commerce company doing a couple hundred K in monthly revenue, right? So the businesses were in different places, but I think seed investing now, the way I would define it is it's pre-A, it's anything that's pre-A. And what's pre-A is like, it's not just add water, right? It's just add capital. You have to have everything kind of figured out. And you can make it a seed investment, even the lot of the e-commerce company, which I was mentioning there, it's like they hadn't figured everything out yet. They've done a couple hundred grand in monthly revenue, but it wasn't just add capital and go. Like, there's still a management team to be rounded out. There's still things about retention we needed to get in place. And now we're going to be able to do that. So I see it as anything before you kind of have it all figured out and it's ready to scale. And so for us, we get less hung up on whether it's pre-seed, what's the label, pre-seed, post-seed. If it's before Series A, we'll do it. And let's figure out the right amount of capital to get to the right next stage. I think one of the things that's different than when we started the firm, before we viewed, okay, you raised the seed round and success was a Series A. I think now, given that seed has really become a spectrum, we'll invest in a company, especially the earlier on, that's a pre-seed. Success doesn't have to mean it raises a $10 million Series A. Success can mean, okay, they raised a, you know, we were part of a 750K round, and now success is they're raising a $3.5 million second seed. And for a while, that was like a dirty, well, you're doing a second seed, that's a bad outcome. Like, I think that's completely gone away now. And now it's like, okay, if you're raising success, you're proving out additional milestones, you're, you know, able to hopefully attract capital beyond the existing players, and let's keep going. That seed is a spectrum.
Yeah. So you've touched on it at certain points of our conversation already, but tell us a little bit more about your background.
Yeah. So think Web 1.0 era. I started an email marketing company. We basically had a series of consumer-facing email newsletters. So one was a deals newsletter, one was a e-commerce newsletter, one was a style focused ones. They think of it almost like a predecessor to Daily Candy. Mm-hmm. And we raised about $1 million in angel financing. And I ended up growing that. Our biggest property ended up growing to about 5 million registered users. And we ended up selling the company to About.com in New York. So I ended up working at About.com in New York for a couple of years as VP of marketing there. So I consider myself an internet marketer first, an entrepreneur second. And then the way I do those things is being an investor. If I wasn't doing this, I wouldn't be like some growth stage investor somewhere. I'd be starting another internet company. That's what I'd be doing. I just want to be part of the beginning over and over again. That startup, it was four of us in the room. There was literally a room with no windows, and it was brick on three sides and drywall on the other side. And that early days are just there's so much raw potential. I just love being there, and being a seed stage VC lets you like get a glimpse of that over and over again.
Yeah, no, definitely. And how did you meet your partners?
The answer is there's actually not a good story behind that. We were all
okay. Good start.
Well, actually, no, there's the story is there's not a good story. We didn't work together. We just knew each other through the VC ecosystem. And we actually joked now, we've been together 10 years, and then Melody's now been with us for 3 years. We kind of got lucky. We have I don't know how else to say it, but like we have such a no drama partnership. And
it's always a good thing.
as we all get along so well, we just got really lucky because I've heard, and I've been part of places that's it's just not the case. And we just got really lucky. And I'm going to keep doing that. I mean, we're pretty young. I mean, I'm in my early 40s. And I've got a couple decades ahead with this crew.
It's great.
Yeah.
And we talked about more availability of funding options for entrepreneurs at the seed stage.
Yeah.
What's the best way to get Dave's attention if I'm an entrepreneur?
I would say the classic thing. I think it's, I don't think, actually, maybe what's the controversial way to say, not controversial, the non-traditional way to say it. I don't think warm intros matter. I think an intro matters, if that makes sense. I don't think it has to be that warm, but I get inbounded so many cold emails that it's hard to filter through all those. So you just have to get some, but unless the intro is like super hot, somebody I completely trust and they say, this is the most important person, you have to completely just, I pay attention to everything there. But the flip side is within the last 3 years, I have invested in a completely cold email. We've gone from, just that cold email, but that cold email was so tailored. It was clear that they wrote it, not just the next few, they wrote it to me and knew why it was a perfect fit for me. And we did extra kind of diligence on the founders, and we did a pre-seed investment, that we did a seed, and we're partners with Lightspeed in the company now. And so the cold email does work. It just can't be a blast. It has to be personalized.
Got it. And on the investing side, there's obviously a lot more funds.
Yeah.
How often do you syndicate with other seed funds? Is that common?
Yeah, I would say we are very syndicate welcoming as a venture firm. Some firms have a mindset of they want to take all or most of the round. Some firms have a mindset of, oh, we've got our favorite partners and we're going to go with them. We actually very much believe in, well, two things. One, there is such thing as like syndicate company fit, if that makes sense, that like different companies should have different syndicates. For example, some of our digital health investments have healthcare investors, right? And they bring a different perspective. And I think they value us similarly, that we're internet-y folks and bringing together a syndicate. Let's say you want a well-rounded syndicate of complementary investors as opposed to a complementary syndicate of well-rounded investors. You don't just want like generic investors. You want like different investors that bring different things to the table. And so it's a long-winded way of saying like we're actually fairly welcoming on the syndicate front. I actually lament, now a little bit because seed rounds are getting bigger, but so are the funds, including ours. And so everyone has their ownership targets. And so whereas it was very clubby, call it 2013-14, it's a little more competitive. But it's still, I think the seed stage is still nowhere near as competitive in terms of the later stages where it's really the later stages, it is either or. There is no real, the old school 15 years ago, two Series A firms doing the Series A together, that just doesn't happen.
No, there's too many choices. And Do you think that this is, we've gotten to a point in the market where the proliferation of seed stage funds is a sustainable kind of status quo going forward? Or do you think that there's going to be another kind of reckoning as we head after kind of the first dot-com era?
Well, a couple trends. I think one, what's interesting to see, even though if you look at the charts on seed dollars specifically, seed dollars have actually been flat for the last 3 or 4 years, and then seed rounds have, the number of rounds getting done has actually been going down. So that translates that the round sizes are getting larger just because of the math. So A, it creates a little bit of have-nots within the actual underlying startups. I actually think you saw the peak seed frenzy in that era, like the 16-17 era. We've been in a market where, the winds begin against our back for the last decade. And so that being said, I think there are seed funds that won't have good returns even in that. And so if you're not going to have good returns even in that wind, there will be some fallout. But I don't paint it in such a stark picture of a day of reckoning is coming. As you get an increasingly mature market, there's two distinct strategies. You compete on size, scale, and scope. And so you get multi-geography, multi-sector, multi-stage firms, or you take a boutique strategy and you specialize along some combination of geography, stage, and theme. And so you're seeing that. And so I think it's fine to have a proliferation of boutiques on the latter end. And obviously that's how we position ourselves similarly. I think you get caught in the middle. I don't, there's successful $350 million Series A funds, but there's a lot less of those. I'd rather be a first-time $40 million seed fund than a first-time $350 million Series A fund.
Right. Yep. And what sort of themes are you most excited about? I know you guys have touched on the verticalization of digital health. What other sort of themes are you predominantly interested in right now?
I think the other coming out of COVID pandemic, I think what is one thing that people do every day? They eat, right? And so we joke and say like everyone has to eat lunch and dinner, right? And so, and there's clearly with between delivery apps and just a lot of change going on within kind of technology enabled within the food business. Mm-hmm. And so that's an area that I in particular are paying a lot of attention to. And maybe it's a little bit contrarian given that we're in the restaurant industry isn't really the best place to be selling things to these days. But I think coming out of this pandemic, we're really going to get an upswing there.
Yeah, definitely. So at this point, we're going to switch over to our four standard question segment. And this is just something that we do in an attempt to get to know you better with all of our guests. And we're looking forward to hearing your answers. Our first question is the National Venture Capital Association question. The NVCA advocates for public policy that supports the venture community and the American entrepreneurial ecosystem. If there's one thing you would change about the VC industry or one policy that you'd advocate for, what would it be?
So I don't think I have a specific policy as the remedy, but I think there can be more done. And I think even COVID pandemic effects have shown this around distributing venture capital to other parts of the country, especially mm-hmm. outside of, you know, the core Silicon Valley, New York, Boston, LA, even Seattle.
Now Miami.
Yeah, now Miami. But I grew up in Pittsburgh. We have not yet, but in the next decade, I'm sure we will invest in a company in Pittsburgh. There are lots of folks coming out of CMU there that are starting companies. And so it's like, I think there can be more done and just not just policy-wise, but I think even within our industry collectively to pay attention to other cities within the U.S. Just for example, within the last 2 years, I've invested in one company in Charlotte, North Carolina, and one company in Richmond, Virginia. And I don't have a particular thesis about either of those geographies specifically, but rather I found two awesome companies that I wanted to be an investor in. And so in both cases, I was able to hop on a plane and spend time with the management teams and be able to make those investments. And so far, both of them are good.
The second question is, if you were not a VC and money wasn't a concern, what career would you have?
So I've already had the best two jobs in the world, which is VC is one. And the other, I was this is one I would go back to. I was a children's ski instructor. So in my 20s, you know, 3 to 6 year old kids.
French fries and the pie, right?
French fries and pizza.
That's all you have to know.
That's all you need to know. I'd get them out there and I would go back to that job. That's a great job to have. I did it then part-time and I would do it again part-time so you can spend a couple other days skiing. But that was a really fun night job. And to see kids go from like literally not being able to, you put on these crazy like 3 foot sticks onto
right.
their feet to be able to like go down and a slippery hill. Like it's pretty amazing to right. see how quickly they can pick that up.
Yeah, no, that's awesome. Do you ski a lot yourself?
I do. And I've got kids, I've got a third grader and a twins are in first grade and I've been trying to do my best to keep them, to teach them as well. But the other thing I learned being a children's ski instructor is you want to give it to someone else to do.
Yeah, requires patience for sure.
To the professionals.
Yeah. Did you ever cross over the dark side and go snowboarding?
No, my roommates at the time, they just implored me to do it.
It's fun. I highly recommend it.
Yeah, I could get up every day and be a better skier.
It does require good knees, which I no longer have, but it's fun. That's awesome. Thank you for sharing that. Number three is, who is someone that you look up to and why?
Yeah, I would say my father-in-law. So my father-in-law is, he's a retired judge. He was judge for a couple decades on Cape Cod. And the only way I could characterize it, he's just a very fair man. He just looks at both sides of things and doesn't come to situations with a preconceived notion and about what he's supposed to think or not think. And like, examines the situation and then makes a decision. And he's just a very fair guy. And I just like that. I like that approach, being able to take a step back. And I try to emulate that in many different aspects of both professionally it helps and as well as personally, obviously as well.
Well, I'm sure he'd be honored to hear you say that. So I hope you have told him that. And if not, he can listen to this podcast.
Yeah, he might be listening to a podcast.
Exactly. Number four is, what's the best piece of advice you've ever received?
So I think the best advice is not to put, I remember somebody, I'll tell you the context. The piece of advice was not to put too much weight into one person's advice. The context was, I remember when I was going to become a father and have my first child, like everyone gives you all this advice. This is how to be a parent. This is what you should do. This is how you should deal with the deliver. This is how you should, you know. And I remember somebody pulled me aside and said, listen, you're going to figure it out your own way. You listen to other people, take other people's advice, but like, you got to assemble, you know, put it all together and then figure out what's best for you. And I think similarly, that works both personally as well as professionally.
Definitely. Everyone has an opinion.
Everyone has an opinion. Yeah. In particular.
Exactly.
David, thank you very much for joining us today. We enjoyed learning more about you and about NextView.
Yeah, good. That was really fun. The conversation was a good one.
And follow us on Twitter @ProofVC or on our website @proof.vc.